You are listening to WPVM LP 103.7 in Asheville, North Carolina, and globally at WPVMFM.org.
This is A Better World, coming to you from the studios of WPVM 103.7 FM in Asheville, North Carolina. And we're streaming live at WPVMFM.org. My name is McNair Ezard, and I'm your host for A Better World. Each week, we take an in-depth look at the people and organizations locally, nationally, and internationally who are working to create a world that works for everyone. And we are fortunate to have with us today Melanie Kaplan. She's a longtime independent journalist whose travel and science writing has appeared in The Atlantic, The Washington Post, The Wall Street Journal, and National Parks Magazine. She is author of the 2025 book, Lab Dog, A Beagle and His Human Investigate the Surprising World of Animal Research. It's a memoir, a book of investigative journalism, and a book about her relationship with Hammy, the beagle who changed her life. The late Jane Goodall said about the book, "This remarkable book moved me deeply. With a journalist's eye and insight, Kaplan brings compassion to a subject that has long needed such a voice. I recommend this book to everyone who cares about animals and the future of science." Melanie Kaplan, welcome to A Better World.
Thank you for having me, McNair.
I appreciate you coming on the show.
Recently, you were in Asheville at Firestorm Books, and how did that event go?
Oh, it was so great. Firestorm was a perfect place for it, and had a terrific conversation with Jason Sellers, who I can't imagine it having been with anyone else. He was just, really interested in the topic, of course, having his vegan restaurants and has cared about animals for a long time. And I always appreciate when someone asks me questions that I haven't heard before, and he was just full of really interesting questions and perspectives, and we had a really good conversation and great audience.
Yeah, it's a great bookstore for progressive ideas and people like yourself, so I'm glad that worked out for you. But before we get into your book, I'd like to ask, have you tell us a bit more about your background and what led you to write this book?
Well, I have been writing for a long time, and really since I was a child, and I've been working as a journalist freelancing for almost 30 years, and I've wanted to write a book for a long time, and as you can imagine, I've written about so many different topics. I mean, at the beginning, it was anybody who would pay me. Started freelancing in Atlanta, and then moved back up to D.C. and went to grad school for journalism somewhere in the middle there. As I progressed in my career, I was able to pick and choose a little bit more what I wanted to write about. And that ended up being a lot of travel writing and writing about animals and science. And, so I'd have these ideas from time to time. And I think, oh, maybe I can write a book about this or this. And it just really wouldn't go anywhere. And somebody said, someone who was a author of a very successful book said, if you have an idea and you're not working on it every day for the next 6 months, you need to move on. I knew it had to be something I was really passionate about, but forcing an idea just wasn't working. And this idea just came to me and I realized I couldn't not write about it.
So have you always been a dog person, and more specifically a hound person?
Yes, I have been. I grew up with dachshunds. My dad was stationed in Germany in the army before I was born, and they brought home a dachshund and then bred the dachshund with the dachshund down the street. We had dachshund puppies, and our dachshunds always had back problems. They're just not shaped well to be jumping up on beds and couches. And so I was already a big fan of hounds. And when I was an adult myself, I did a lot of research into what breed of dog I'd be interested in having in my life. And I just thought the beagles, for all their faults, all of their, falling their noses and howling, I just thought I had to have a beagle. So my first beagle was Darwin, and she and I drove across the country and did a lot of road trips together. And Hammy just continued that tradition when we had our 10 years together.
Your book is in part about your dog, Hammy, who you just mentioned. How did you two come into each other's life?
So I met Hammy in 2013. I had learned about an organization that was helping get beagles out of research labs. And a friend of mine told me about this organization, and I signed up to be a foster because I was dog free during that time. I had lost Darwin, and it had been several years. And I just was like, well, Darwin was my only dog. I will never have another dog. But I thought, I'll foster. You know, this is interesting. I don't know anything about dogs and research. And so I met Hammy, and there were six other beagles that were brought out of the lab that same day. And the other fosters and I met these dogs, and we kind of all paired up with one and brought them home. And these dogs were, for the most part, really nervous and scared and just not used to any of the sounds and sights in the world. I mean, they had been confined. Most of them were about 4 years old or almost four. And so Hammy, you know, had never walked upstairs before. He didn't know how to jump. He didn't know how to use his nose, sniff for things. And the first, you know, months were really tricky, just getting him to go out and go for a walk and not be terrified and start trembling. So it required a lot of patience for months and really years. He had some special needs and just needed somebody to really be, I think, very thoughtful and careful and patient with him.
How did he take to you in those initial days and weeks after you adopted him?
I was a little nervous that he wasn't going to trust people because I didn't know anything about his background. I didn't know if he'd been hurt or abused. I was prepared for him to not want to connect with me, but from the very first night I brought him home, he would look in my eyes and he kind of did this cute thing with his paw where he would reach out and paw me when I stopped petting him. Mm-hmm. And so I just knew right away, like, okay, there is hope. We can bond, and he is food motivated. I had my treats, and I had my, you know, just connection with him that I was starting to build. And so we went from there day by day.
I understand that it took you a while after getting Hammy that you decided to write the book. What happened that started you thinking in that direction?
Like I said, I didn't think I was going to adopt him. It was a full month of fostering him. So, you know, I didn't come home from fostering and start taking notes. I didn't think I was going to write about it. I just thought this will be a little side gig. And by the time I, you know, realized I needed to write about this, I, you know, didn't have any pictures, didn't have any notes from those first days. I had to kind of rebuild a lot of those scenes for the book. But I introduced Hammy to, I mean, probably thousands of people over the years, just when we traveled and people in the neighborhood and friends and family. And, you know, he and I would travel a lot, take road trips. And I would always say, this is Hammy. He was in a lab for several years. And I would show them the tattoo in his ear because all these dogs are bred specifically for research. So he had a 6-letter tattoo in his left ear. It's kind of big blue letters. And that's how these dogs are identified. And it tells, you know, can tell somebody who understands what these letters mean when, like, what year the dog was born, what time of the month, something about the litter. And people were pretty consistently shocked that dog research and testing is happening in the United States today. And they would say things like, well, is this legal? Or, you know, why are we breeding dogs? What's happening? And I really didn't know the answers to these things. I just said, yes, it's legal, and, you know, terrible that he had this background, and we'd carry on. And so it really became, you know, it was probably 8 years we'd been together, and the pandemic happened. I lost all of my freelance work, and then on top of that, I got a concussion. So I had many months when I was not working, and I had some time to really think about what I wanted to write next, you know, what kind of stories were interesting to me, and And I just couldn't ignore the fact that this dog was on the couch next to me and he had this big story and all these unanswered questions. And so that's when I decided to dig into his past and the bigger story.
Well, let me ask you about animal testing in general. I know you're probably aware of most of these statistics, and people tend to get glassy-eyed when they hear them on the radio, but I still want to read them, just kind of give folks an idea about what's happening with animal research, if I may. And I think these were from the World Animal Foundation, which had some astounding statistics, and I don't mean astounding in a positive way. And a bit later, we'll go into the way that dogs and specifically beagles are used in experimentation. But let me share some of these stats. I think one of them was 100 million animals are used every year in scientific experimentation. And I'm not sure exact date of these, but here's one from 2015. That's 192 million animals were used for scientific purposes. 2022, 8.39 million conducted in Europe on animals. And I was surprised about this. Half of the NIH budget, and I understand that may have changed now, which counts for $23 billion, goes for animal experimentation in the U.S. each year. And NIH had, or maybe still has, at least 7,000 research monkeys. And I'm just astounded by these figures, and there's a lot more. But in researching your book, what sorts of information did you come across in relation to animal testing, especially here in the U.S.?
Yeah, the numbers really are astounding. I did not look too much into global numbers, but I can tell you when I first adopted Hammy, there were 70,000 dogs in labs in the United States. And that number has gone down slowly since the 1960s. In the 60s, there were close to 500,000 dogs used every year in the U.S. And some of those dogs were even pet dogs that were stolen from backyards. So the numbers decreased a lot. Now there's, or 2024, the last number that we have from the USDA was just over 40,000 dogs used every year in the U.S. But dogs are a pretty small percentage of the total numbers. The vast majority of animals used are mice and rats. And surprisingly, the USDA, Department of Agriculture, which regulates animal testing and animal research facilities, they do not even require mice and rats to be counted. So we do not even have a clear number on those. There have been some estimates that more than 100 million mice and rats are used every year in the US alone, but we don't have a real count of that. So we know that there are a lot of animals used, and most of them are not counted. Dogs, the numbers are going down, but 40,000 is still a lot of dogs.
Yes. What surprised you most about what you found out?
There were a lot of surprises. I mean, I went in knowing very little. I think that the scale of this industry really surprised me. I was picturing that research dogs were maybe bred in some kind of backyard operation, and it is not like that at all. I mean, this is big business. The place where he was born was owned by a public company, and it's a big industrial operation. I mean, there were 5,000 beagles bred there where he was born. That place has since closed. And there's another breeder in upstate New York called Marshall Bioresources. And they often have more than 20,000 beagles there at any given time. And so they sell their dogs to pharmaceutical companies, universities, private labs, probably, I'm guessing, some vet schools. I know that certainly the one in Virginia did. That closed. So they have regular customers, and they buy these what are called purpose-bred dogs, and they're used for experiments. And most of them are killed at the end of the experiments because their part of the study includes looking at their tissues or their organs and weighing them and looking at where cancer is spread or how disease has manifested. And so most are not adopted out. Hammy and the six who came out with him are definitely the minority.
So is there any kind of oversight of these breeders by the government?
There is, and that is regulated just like the labs. It's regulated by the U.S. Department of Agriculture. Mm-hmm. So they are supposed to go in annually and you know, look at things like the conditions and the ratio of staff to animals. And the one in Virginia that I mentioned, which was owned by Invigo at the time it closed, it changed hands many, many times since it had opened in the 60s. But that one had so many USDA violations that the company eventually, you know, said they could not upgrade the facility enough, or they chose not to. They didn't actually say they couldn't. And so they ended up closing. But there were violations around, you know, there were bugs in food. The medical care was really abysmal. Dogs would get in fights and, you know, an ear would be bleeding or a foot would be hurt. And they, instead of treating the dog, they would euthanize them. They were depriving feeding mothers, the nursing mothers, from food, and just kind of a way to, you know, experiment with that. I mean, there were just all kinds of violations. And so anyway, that became really big news. And you might remember in 2022, there were 4,000 beagles that were transferred out of that facility and adopted into homes. So they are regulated. And, you know, the problem is when you have that many animals, whether it's ferrets or beagles or cows, I mean, thousands of them, nobody is getting individual attention. And you're treating them as commodities. And, you know, it's really about the bottom line. Like I said, this is a public company.
I would imagine that even though there is regulation of those industries, are there also people who deal in animals that, like, go under the radar of regulation?
I would be surprised if that were not the case. Mm-hmm. I don't know of mm-hmm. cases like that. You know, and certainly in other areas, I mean, you've got roadside zoos, and you've got people dealing with exotic animals and breaking the law all the time. Mm-hmm. I mean, the big story with going under the radar with animal research was back in the 60s and before then, before the Animal Welfare Act was passed in 1966, there were a lot of dogs stolen from people's backyards. There was a famous dog in Pennsylvania named Pepper, a Dalmatian who was stolen, and that made big national news, and she kind of became the poster dog for the, you know, the interest and the concern that led to President Johnson signing the Animal Welfare Act. And I would say that stealing pets did not stop immediately after that, but that was the main reason that that law was passed, so it could be regulated, and the labs had to, you know, say where they bought the dogs, and they had to report mm-hmm. the number of dogs and other animals. So, you know, I don't know what's happening under the radar. It was hard enough to get the research industry to talk mm-hmm. to me about what mm-hmm. they were doing.
I bet.
Above the, yes, exactly.
If you just joined us, you're listening to a conversation with Melanie Kaplan. She's author of the book Lab Dog, A Beagle and His Human Investigate the Surprising World of Animal Research. And you're listening to us on A Better World at 103.7 WPVM in Asheville, North Carolina. And that he knows he'll get. So I love my dog as much as I love you. But you make a fame. My dog will always come through. All the pay I need comes a shining through his eyes. I don't need no cold water to make me realize that I love my dog as much as I love you. But you make a fame. My dog will always come through. Okay, that's Cat Stevens singing I Love My Dog from the album Matthew and Son. Melanie, let me ask you specifically about beagles. Why are they such a popular breed for research and testing?
Well, the answer that I heard over and over is that because beagles are really docile and friendly and compliant, and they're easy to work with. And all of that is true, but there are many breeds that are docile and easy to work with and friendly. So what I learned in my research is that there's just a really long history of using beagles back to, you know, the 50s and before. Beagles were brought to this country after the Civil War as hunting dogs. And so there were a lot of kennels that were breeding beagles for hunting, and they're always trying to breed a better beagle and a disease-free beagle. And Cornell actually opened up a lab that was looking at dog diseases like distemper. And so they were studying things like this. And eventually they realized that they can make more money or additional money by also using dogs for human studies. So beagles started being used for studies on radioactive substances in around 1950. All across the country, the Atomic Energy Commission was doing these tests to see about the effects of radiation. And those studies ended up using thousands of beagles, really awful experiments. And then you've got a system of breeding beagles and having, you know, beagle puppies and litters and breeding, and it's just become a big system. Then the pharmaceutical industry starts needing to test on animals, and the beagles are available. And other countries followed our lead from the FDA's use of beagles. So I think once the system was in place, it was just, they became the go-to breed. They're not the only breed. I mean, I've read about dachshunds and greyhounds and golden retrievers and Irish setters. So a lot of other dogs have been used for research, but it's really mostly beagles.
There was something in your book which I hadn't heard of before. It was called pound seizure. Can you tell us about that? I was taken aback when I heard about that.
Yeah, pound seizure is the, it means that researchers or labs can get dogs from shelters. And in some cases, they have to allow the labs to take the dogs from the shelters. Oklahoma is currently the only state that still requires it, and many states have outlawed it. So that just means if you're, you know, you lose your dog and your dog ends up in the shelter, and say they have to wait 3 days or 5 days to see if someone comes to pick up the dog. If that doesn't happen, then that dog is fair game for lab use. So it's really, this does not happen nearly as much as it used to, I'd say in the 60s, 70s. But like I said, there's still one state that requires that to happen. Really, it's really surprising.
So when we talk about research, you mentioned about pharmaceuticals. Are we talking also about universities? I know I mentioned NIH earlier on, or private industry other than pharmaceuticals?
Absolutely. And the number that you did mention, you said half of NIH's budget goes to animal research, and that is still current as far as I know. We don't have exact figures from them, but NIH is the largest funder of animal research in the world. And, you know, biomedical research is different. I mean, that's exploratory research. It's kind of asking questions about how a disease works through the body, or, you know, how systems work in the body versus a very specific product test, which is, you know, a drug test or a pesticide test on animals. But absolutely, I mean, the NIH funds a lot of this, and as do, you know, corporations and the pharmaceutical companies, like you mentioned.
I read it on one website, and this number may not be accurate, that in the U.S. alone, there are something like 250 companies and other institutions that use dogs in experiments each year. Does that number seem fairly accurate to you?
I don't know that number. I don't know for sure, but that doesn't seem like it would be far-fetched at all. You know, most universities that do research that have large animals. I would say most of them have dogs. There's two that I ran into where they have specifically moved away from using dogs because they said they just didn't learn that much more from dogs, or that the public relations were just too much of an issue. So I think that Humane World for Animals has a good map of, you know, statistics on the states that use dogs. And mm-hmm. I think it's the majority of states. There's a handful that don't have use any dogs, but most of them do, whether it's, you know, universities or private companies.
Yeah, you mentioned Humane World for Animals. I read that one of the disadvantages from animal experiments, especially with dogs, is that they don't accurately mimic how the human body and human diseases respond to drugs, chemicals, or treatments. Did you come across any information about that when you were researching?
The one statistic that I remember is that more than 9 out of 10 drugs that are successful in animal tests end up failing in human clinical trials because they're either toxic to humans or they're just not effective. And, you know, look, these drugs can fail for a number of reasons. I mean, this is a really long process from identifying the drug to testing on animals, to testing with some non-animal methods, and then eventually human clinical trials. And, you know, it's often billion or billions of dollars from these pharmaceutical companies are spending. But, you know, if that larger percentage of these drugs are not working, you would think that we would want to figure out something that is more effective. So now a lot of people are talking about human relevant methods, which means using non-animal methods. You're using like computer little organ chips or computer modeling, AI, organoids, which are little 3D tissue structures made from stem cells. And so, you know, when I say these are human relevant, these are using human cells. So they're not using rabbit cells or monkey cells or beagle cells, which, sure, we've learned a lot from animal experimentation over the years, over the centuries, but we've also made a lot of progress. And we know that we are not the same. I mean, look, we eat chocolate and dogs cannot eat chocolate. So that's, that's just one example that you hear over and over again from people who are pushing for better science that, I mean, we might share a lot of diseases with some of these animals, but we are different. We are different species. So not surprising that some of these things don't translate.
In your book, you talk about animal models. Is that where this idea you were just talking about, alternative means of testing that they're coming up with these days?
Right. So the animal models, I mean, that's what's been used for centuries because rather than experimenting on humans, which we can't do without their consent. I mean, that wasn't always the case, of course, but, an animal model could be anything. It could be a fruit fly. It could be a chimpanzee when they were used, which was up until a decade ago. And they are just trying to model for human biomedical research because all of this is for our benefit. I mean, some researchers will say, oh, well, it also helps dogs. And that might be a trickle-down benefit, but it's really the driving force behind this is for human medicine and human medical devices and keeping us healthier, longer, and better. And, it's not to make the lives of these other animals better.
You mentioned about medical research, and I see this now more on like cosmetic products where it says, no animal experimentation used in the development of this product. So there's a difference between the biomedical research and, say, just as an example, the cosmetic research. Are those the cosmetic industry still using a lot of animals for their research?
Yeah, this is a really good point. When I went into the research for the book, I thought I was doing so well because I was buying cruelty-free shampoo and and soap and dishwashing detergent. And I thought, okay, I got this. And then I realized, all these drugs are tested on animals and there's no such thing as a cruelty-free drug because you know, everything on the market today has been tested on an animal. There is very recently a category of drugs where the FDA has said animals don't have to be used, but that's a very small segment. And, you know, pesticides, there's no cruelty-free pesticides. Every pesticide is still tested on dogs for 90 days, everything. So that's, you know, lawn fertilizer, bug spray, roach killer, you know, not to mention that they're killing, you know, the pests, but they're also killing dogs and other animals to test all these pesticides. So the cosmetics industry actually has been a huge success. It's slightly, you know, it's a slightly different category than if we're thinking about our health versus our beauty. So I think that was a low-hanging fruit back in the 80s when there was a lot of pressure for these companies like Revlon to stop testing their products on, you know, bunnies and other animals. And so for the most part, from what I understand, cosmetics are not tested on animals. But, you know, I asked a lot of my contacts in the animal advocacy world, well, why isn't everything cruelty-free? And the answer that I got is because some of these companies are also selling overseas. So if there's another country that does require animal testing and the company wants to sell there, then they might still do it. So PETA has a really good list on their website, and the Leaping Bunny program is also a great resource. So those two are good places to go to see which companies do not do any testing on animals. But again,
I have to ask you, what's the Leaping Bunny?
So the Leaping Bunny is it's a certification program that will certify that your company does not use animal testing. So often if you pick up a bottle of shampoo or soap or any cosmetic or body product, if you see a little bunny on the back, that is the Leaping Bunny. And they have a really helpful website that explains exactly what the criteria are.
Our guest today is Melanie Kaplan. She's a longtime independent journalist whose travel and science writing has appeared in The Atlantic, The Washington Post, The Wall Street Journal, and National Parks Magazine. And she's author of the book, Lab Dog, A Beagle and His Human Investigate the Surprising World of Animal Research. And you're listening to A Better World at 103.7 WPVM in Asheville, North Carolina. And we're streaming live at WPVMFM.org.
Yeah.
Okay, welcome back. That's Paul McCartney singing Looking for Changes. And that song is from 2019 when McCartney, an outspoken animal rights activist, donated the song to PETA to their campaign to end experiments on animals. And our guest today is Melanie Kaplan, author of the book Lab Dog, Beagle and His Human Investigate the Surprising World of Animal Research. Melanie, in your experience and result of your research for the book, did you ever feel like the means were ever justified to achieve some of the results that have come of animal testing?
That is such a tough question. You know, I think what we have learned up until now, a lot of it has come from animal research, and I'm thankful for it. And I remember learning in my research that the first successful blood transfusion happened in the 1600s, and that was between two dogs. And I needed a blood transfusion maybe 15 years ago. So I'm thankful for that and a lot of the other medical advances. But, you know, it's just really hard to square this when you think about the lives of all these animals. And we don't have any guarantees when we go into this. I mean, one thing I write about is the harm-benefit analysis. And today, we do not do that. We being, you know, our research industry in this country, we are not saying, okay, what is the harm to these individuals versus what are we going to get out of it? Because progress in science is often so incremental and so slow. And so these researchers don't know, is this going to be part of a big breakthrough 10 years from now? Or is this going to just be repeating what somebody else did and lead to a dead end? So, mm-hmm. You know, it's just really complicated. But I do know that, you know, Hammy, I had a very different relationship with Hammy than I had with any of the other animals in my life. And I think it's because he needed a lot of care. And I really saw him as an individual, not just a dog, not just a beagle who was in my life. And, you know, he had his own fears and desires and dislikes. And every single one of these animals who's in a research lab confined has that same thing. They all have personalities. So, you know, when I think about that, it's really hard for me to justify any of what's happening.
That kind of leads me to want to ask a question about ethics. Are there any kind of national standards here in the U.S. or any other country? I know most of your research was in the U.S. that try to ethically guide the use of research on animals and dogs, aside from what the Animal Welfare Act tried to cover, which was like regulate housing and transportation. But are there any like ethical standards?
There are certainly some people talking about ethics. Ethics are not a big part of the conversation in terms of NIH funding. I think that if a scientist can justify an experiment, even if this experiment is painful, and say, well, you know, if we give this animal a painkiller, it's going to mess up the study. And so there's a column in the USDA report, annual report of the numbers, there's a column for whether or not the animals experienced pain that was not, you know, dealt with a painkiller or something. So I think if they can justify it, then it happens. There's no upper limit of pain. There's not a discussion about, is this ethical? And I don't know what's happening in other countries. I know that we are one of the largest users of animals in the world. And I also don't think that there are regular ethics courses. I mean, there are some lab animal veterinarians I talked to who did talk a lot about ethics, and they're often the ones who are pushing the researchers and the labs to do better, maybe to euthanize an animal earlier so that they're not suffering longer. One of the veterinarians was telling me about some study where they had given some mice, I can't remember if it was like a influenza type of thing, but you know, basically the animals were getting sicker and sicker and sicker. And he encouraged them to kill the animals sooner He said, we learned what we need to learn. We don't need to have them carry this out. And so, you know, there are small steps like that happening, but I did not hear about across the board ethics courses or studies that are required to go into this industry. And it's definitely not a required discussion when there's funding for animal research.
Something keeps coming back to mind that you mentioned earlier, and that was about the pesticide use. And I'm wondering how many times does an experiment get repeated before they see that it doesn't make any sense to keep torturing these animals by feeding them weed killer or insect repellent. I'm just imagining there's a lot of duplication and regular duplication of torture for these animals and things they learn repetitively that don't need to be repeated.
I think that happens in all areas of animal research and testing. I mean, for pesticides in particular, there was until fairly recently a year-long dog study. And so there were long discussions between animal advocates and the EPA, which is the one in charge of these pesticide studies, the one regulating it. And they finally decided, hey, we're not learning that much more with the dogs being studied for a year versus 90 days. So that's when they cut out the year-long study, and now they're only doing the 90-day study. And of course, now the animal advocates are pushing, you know, saying we don't even need the 90-day study. Are we actually learning that much more than we do from the mice, for example? But you're absolutely right. These tests are repeated over and over and over. And if there is a new pesticide that has a longer lasting chemical or a new scent or some kind of new product, because, you know, we are Americans. We love to consume. We love new products. We're buying things all the time. That's a whole new study. And these dogs are dosed very, very high amounts of pesticide, or in drug testing, it would be the drug. I mean, sometimes hundreds of times the amount that we would ingest of a drug. And then there's different levels of dosing, and then, you know, their bodies are studied afterwards. But I also know in biomedical research, there's a lot of repetition, because I think there's very little or relatively little collaboration between universities working on projects. It's not like all the universities studying diabetes are working together and making sure that they're not repeating anything, because, you know, there's secrecy and they want to make sure, you know, everybody wants to kind of have their own proprietary work. And sometimes they're working with a pharmaceutical company. So I don't think that there's a whole lot of sharing. So inherently there will be repetition, and that's animal lives.
Has there been any update to the Animal Welfare Act? You mentioned that I think in the 60s it was passed. President Johnson, have there been any updates since then, or are there any other laws that are in effect now in addition to that one?
It has been updated. There were, I think it was 1985, if I'm getting that right, when they added a requirement for exercise for dogs, and it might have also mentioned the size of the dog cage, but they don't say specifically what exercise means. So that could be, you know, turning around in their cage, or it could be getting out and, you know, walking in the hallway for a few minutes. So I think that's at the discretion of each lab. There have been some other small updates, but there's always a push for adding more animals into the Animal Welfare Act, because right now the ones that are covered, I mean, there are hundreds of species covered, just so many different types of birds. Like there's some flamingos and some penguins, but it's mostly, you know, it's dogs, cats, pigs, monkeys, ferrets, rabbits. And then, like I said, the mice and rats aren't covered, fish aren't covered, most birds aren't covered. So there really is, there are a lot of people lobbying to have the Animal Welfare Act be more inclusive. I think it's changed very little since 1966. It's surprising to me that it's been around that long and it's still mostly what it was back then.
You write in your book about Alexandra Horowitz, and from the, I think she's from the Dog Cognition Lab at Barnard College in Manhattan. And she talks about the how dogs can't be a dog. You know, they can't be the dog that they are genetically promised to be when they're born or come as a dog. Can you talk about what she pointed to in terms of how being in a lab stunts certain things about being a dog?
Yeah, I love that line. When we were talking on the phone and she said that, I think it just kind of took my breath away because, you know, you think about who these animals are supposed to be, you know, what they were genetically promised. So beagles, we think of them as big sniffing dogs, all hounds, right? And when I first brought Hammy home, he did not know how to sniff because he had been confined in this largely sterile environment. And I mean, I remember I had signed him up very prematurely for a nose work class where, you know, you go to the class and he's got to sniff things out. And I ended up dropping out that first day because I realized, you know, he's just not ready for this. But I was throwing pieces of chicken on the ground and, you know, he was scared and he just wasn't sniffing them out. And so over time, I worked with him and I trained him to sniff and we did little scavenger hunts all the time and I would hide treats around the house or friends' houses. And over time, he had to learn to have a great nose. But the fact that he didn't do that when I first brought him home was just so heartbreaking to me because, you know, that's kind of their superpower, beagles, is sniffing. So, you know, I also learned that he loved going to new places and sniffing new things. And he loved going to the beach and hiking. So, you know, if this was what he was genetically promised, it felt like a real honor to me to be able to introduce him to those things.
You're listening to A Better World at 103.7 WPVM in Asheville, North Carolina. And our guest today on A Better World is Melanie Kaplan, author of the book Lab Dog, A Beagle and His Human Investigate the Surprising World of Animal Research. The dog about everything. There in my truck, the dog and I. Then one day the king up and died. Then I thought about the times we had. Once when I kicked him when he was bad. Old King sure meant a lot to me. But that hound dog is history.
Okay, that's Neil Young singing Old King from his album Harvest Moon. And we are in the final quarter of the hour with Melanie Kaplan, author of the book Lab Dog. Melanie, what's the current Washington administration's stance towards this topic of animal testing? Is it a concern or has it been a concern to them?
Well, it's been interesting. Since the beginning of the administration, they have been talking about moving away from animal research, that it is not ethical or effective, and that there is an interest in moving more toward these non-animal methods that I mentioned. So the NIH has made a statement about that, the FDA, and then the EPA has said that they will not be using mammals anymore after 2035, which is similar to what the Trump administration said during the first administration. So no laws have been changed. There's no new policies, but the NIH did come out and say that when they put out a request for proposals or for grants for their animal research, they're not saying anymore, we want a monkey experiment on XYZ. They will say, you know, we're looking for the study on XYZ, and the researcher can then decide to propose using monkeys or non-animal methods or a combination. But I think that's a really important shift because they are saying that they're accepting the non-animal methods and they're not requiring the animals anymore. So I think it's not going to happen overnight. And same thing with drug testing. Even though there is an opening to use some of these non-animal methods, it means that the FDA regulators who have only been used to looking at animal data all these years have to learn to understand the non-animal data and feel good about it really showing that a drug is safe. I mean, the last thing they want to do is put a drug on the market that is not going to be safe for humans. But hopefully some of these other methods that are using human cells will be more effective.
Are there certain kinds of testing that researchers say is just not possible without using animals?
Yes. I think researchers would say that a lot of the testing is not possible without using animals, that they want to see a whole living system and they want to see how a drug reacts or how, you know, something happens with a disease in a whole body. And I mean, look, I'm not a scientist. I don't feel qualified to say whether they're right or wrong, but there's a lot of people who know much more about this than I do. I just think that the non-animal methods are not well known enough in some of these labs. I mean, there is guidance to consider these non-animal methods, but I don't think people working in the labs absolutely have to use them if they're available. They still have a choice to use animals or not. And these are animal labs. I mean, these are big labs that institutions or private companies are funding and, you know, ordering animals and caring for animals. And this is a really big system that is not going to turn into a non-animal lab overnight. So I think that, you know, making sure that everybody's aware of these non-animal methods, training early career scientists to understand that they don't have to use animals is all really important right now.
Well, you mentioned earlier in the show that the number of, I think it was dogs you were talking about, number of dogs in use for research has slowly gone down since the 60s. What do you attribute that trend to?
I think part of it is that there are more of other species being used. In some cases, especially in education, dogs were used for a long time in med schools. Like students would go to a dog lab and they would learn about anatomy and learn about how drugs make their way through a body. And they would, you know, euthanize these dogs. And that was pretty common in med schools. And then there's a lot of pressure to not use dogs. And some of the schools started using pigs. And eventually there were no pigs in labs and med schools. And currently all of the med schools in North America do not use live animals and their training, which is a huge win. They still use animals for some advanced medical training, but not in med schools. So I think that's part of it. Public pressure, you know, some universities just don't want to deal with donors and students and alumni knowing that they use dogs, you know. And then also, now that we have one of these big dog breeding facilities has closed, there's another one in Wisconsin that is not going to be able to sell their dogs for research. They've given up their commercial breeding license as of this July. So there's just fewer dogs being bred too. And it'll be interesting to see what happens, you know, in terms of the breeders, if the breeder in New York ends up breeding more dogs. But, you know, we certainly don't want fewer dogs to be used, but more pigs or monkeys or rabbits. Mm-hmm. That doesn't feel like a success.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But were there parts of this book that were more difficult emotionally for you to write about?
Oh, so much of it was difficult. I had to take a lot of breaks. And if this didn't feel like something I had to write, I would have stopped a number of times. But, you know, I had Hammy with me, and he somehow reminded me that I had to tell this story. So it was just never a question. I had to keep moving forward. But he became my therapy dog in a lot of ways. And, you know, we took a lot of breaks and walks and got out on the paddleboard together and spent time in nature, because this is a difficult subject. I mean, it's very personal, and the book is about my relationship with this creature who came out of a lab, and, you know, how much I love him and our love together, just as much as it is a science book. But yeah, it's tough. And I had to stop and take a deep breath many times.
So how did meeting Hammy and getting involved in this project change your life?
Well, this book would not exist without Hammy, for sure. Mm-hmm. And, you know, shortly after I adopted him, I completely became plant-based in my kitchen. And that was a real easy switch, just in terms of being kinder to animals and thinking about my impact on the world. And, you know, that as I learned more, I started consuming fewer products that were connected to this. So I'm real careful if I need to get a drug or something over the counter. You know, I ask, do I really need to get this? I actually have a quandary coming up because I'm going to do a story down at Cumberland Island National Seashore off the coast of Georgia. And I keep hearing how buggy it is. And so I'm thinking, oh my God, am I going to, you know, I really don't want to buy bug spray. Like I keep saying, I'm not buying bug spray these days. So I'm just planning on wearing long shirt and long pants. And but I think about it all the time. I mean, animal research and testing touches so many things in our lives. And once I knew about it all, you know, I can't unknow it. So it's on my mind. And, you know, Hammy's influenced me in so many ways.
Well, you're kind of hinting at this next question, but is there anything that individuals can do to make a difference in this field in relation to animal research and testing, in addition to just not buying their products?
Yeah, I think that, you know, companies do respond to consumer feedback. So if there's a company that is still using animals, I would say, you know, write them a letter and write to your representatives. A lot of the lawmakers, you know, state and federal, don't know a lot about this topic still. I worked closely with one senator and a state senator in Maryland and Virginia who became, you know, very, very supportive of these bills that do better protecting animals and research. And, you know, they're both dog people, but they just care about animals a lot. And so, you know, I would say educate yourself and write to your lawmakers, let them know that you don't want to have these breeding facilities in your state, or you don't want to have dog research at institutions in your state. See what your alma mater is doing. You know, I would not be surprised if they are doing some animal research, even if it's not dogs, it's probably mice or zebrafish. And, you know, just speak up about this. Obviously read Lab Dog and, you know, and just talk about it, because what I learned is that most people just don't know that it's happening. And, you know, I think we owe it to animals in general to be educated consumers and voters and patients. And we do have a say in this.
Well, on that note, I want to thank Melanie Kaplan for coming on the show today. She's a longtime independent journalist whose travel and science writing has appeared in many national publications. And she's author of Lab Dog: A Beagle and His Human Investigate the Surprising World of Animal Research. Melanie, thank you so much for coming on the show, and all the best to you, and good luck with the book.
Thank you, McNair. Thanks, sir. It's been a great conversation.
I'm just walking my dog, singing my song, strolling along.
You've been listening to A Better World at 103.7 WPVM in Asheville, North Carolina. This is McNair Ezard. Thank you for joining us, and hopefully we'll see you next time on A Better World. And we're going out today with the dog song from Nellie McKay from the album Get Away From Me.
Then there was you appeared when I was entangled with youth and fear, and nerves jangle jangled, vermouth and beer were getting me mangled up. But then I looked in your eyes, and I was no more a failure. You looked so wacky and wise, and I said, Lord, I'm happy, cause I'm just walking my dog, singing my song, strolling along. Oh, it's just me and my dog, catching some sun. We can't go wrong.